So, okay, back to the Buddha. So we last week we finished up with whatever we were going to say about the first section of the book. So now we're in the second section of Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, and his title for this is The Bringer of Light. So first, you know, the human condition, then a little bit about the person who's going to help us to deal with this human condition, the Buddha. So in Zen, maybe you've noticed from Zen literature, or maybe you've never thought about this, but the Buddha is mentioned now and again in Zen literature, but not all the time. The Buddha is not the sort of center of Zen, the Zen world, actually. And when the Buddha is mentioned, quite often the Buddha is mentioned in a very familiar way, sometimes even in a sort of a mocking way. And the more I think about it, the more I appreciate that Zen's radical non-dualism seems to sort of logically or naturally lead to a way of practice that includes a certain amount of humor and irony, much of which is heaped on the Buddha in the Zen literature. Sometimes they say, Shakyamuni Buddha is only halfway there. He's still working on his practice, poor fellow. They refer to him as old Shakyamuni, you know, like a run-down, broken-down old guy. So I like that aspect of Zen, that tone of voice. If, as Suzuki Roshi tells us, things are not always so, then even when you take things pretty seriously, you also have to take them with a grain of salt, or sand, or whatever you call it. But even that's probably not always so. So traditional Zen teachers talk a lot more about the old Zen masters from China than they do about the Buddha. So you notice that in the Zen literature. But I have always felt like the Buddha is our teacher. And so I have always felt that we should appreciate the Buddha and know something about the Buddha and understand and have an affectionate feeling for the character of the Buddha, and pay attention to the things that he teaches and try our best to emulate him. But while we do that, it's a good idea to keep the attitude of our Zen ancestors in the back of our minds so that we don't get overly pious in our appreciation of the Buddha, because then we get so stuck on the Buddha that we would lose track of ourselves, and that would kind of not be the point at all. So the Buddha of the Pali Canon is not the same as the Buddha of Zen, and it's also not the same as the Buddha of the Mahayana scriptures. In the Mahayana scriptures, the Buddha has almost no vestige whatsoever of being a person. The Buddha in those scriptures is completely a spiritual principle of awakening, which has a sort of cosmic dimension to it. It's bigger than the mundane notion of awakening that you and I hope to experience and put to practice in our lives. It's a big, big picture. So Mahayana awakening is a cosmic affair, which involves worlds upon worlds, eons upon eons, stretching through endless space and time. In the Pali literature, as we see, the Buddha is really a person who feels pleasure and pain, who gets ill from time to time, who has his struggles, and so on. At the same time, in other passages in the same Pali literature, we learn that the Buddha is, as our chapter title suggests, the bringer of light to a world engulfed in darkness. And it made me think of the famous poem, you know, that was written, like an epic poem, written in 1879 by Sir Edwin Arnold, called The Light of Asia. It's a very famous book that was read for a couple of generations. The Light of Asia, being the life and teaching of Gautama, Prince of India and Founder of Buddhism, is the full title of the poem. And it was read by British people, and it was read by, I remember, like, I had an edition of it, you know, that I still have somewhere, with an introduction by an eminent Harvard professor, you know, who wrote it in the early part of the 20th century. So this poem was really popular, and it had a lot to do with kindling the Western interest in Buddhism. And the Western interest originally saw Buddhism through the prism of Victorian England as the rational, serene, clear, and ethical alternative to a kind of somewhat messy and superstitious Christianity, much more logical and rational and in keeping with scholarship and so on. So the Pali Canon contains actually both senses of the Buddha, as a person, a wise spiritual teacher in the world, but also as a cosmic Buddha, miraculously born into this eon after countless eons of previous practice. The Buddha, even in the Pali Canon, is seen as one in a long line of Buddhas stretching way in the past and into the future, but the Buddha for this eon, for this world system, who was born for the benefit of beings, for the happiness and welfare of all. So we might ourselves, with our perspective and point of view, we might, although we're quite different from the Victorians, like them, we might have a tendency to dismiss this cosmic Buddha as a product of ancient superstition and to want to pay more attention to Buddha, the great sage and psychologist. But I think it's also really human to make myth and to use the imagination to express feelings that we have that are more than rational. And when I say myth and imagination, I don't mean to say less real. In fact, it could be that the world of the imagination is more real than the material world projected by our limited minds. And maybe we too, like the ancients, have a need to imagine the light of the world embodied in a person that we can respect and name and offer incense to and prostrations and so on. Anyway, the Pali Canon depicts, in a sense, you know, almost side by side, two different Buddhas at the same time. And I think that we need to appreciate them both and not, you know, say one is better than the other, one is truer than the other, but see how they both need to fit together. One final point before I look at some of the text with you. The Buddha of the Pali Canon is a teacher for people and gods, for humans and gods. So often the gods are asking the Buddha for advice and teachings. But also, excuse me, the Buddha in the Pali Canon is the teacher for, and this is a really important point, for both for monks and lay people. Even though he's a monastic and hangs around with monastics and is often teaching monastics, there's a lot of material in the Pali Canon where the Buddha is addressing people in villages and kings and so on. And so they divide the path. They say there's two aspects to the path, the mundane path and the supra-mundane path. So the mundane path is the way for lay people to live with more peace and harmony and ease, basically through the cultivation of wholesome states of mind and heart and wholesome conduct, and to be able to identify unwholesome states of mind and unwholesome conduct and let go of it, and in this way really bring a lot of peace to lay life. For monks, the goal is to enter nirvana. That's the supra-mundane path, to go beyond all this and put out the fires of craving entirely so that there is no more arising whatsoever of craving. In other words, not to just manage the problem, but to completely root it out. Now, of course, in order for them to do this, the monks also have to master the mundane path too, because otherwise it'll, you know, their, the messes that they make in their ethical and emotional life will make such a problem for them that they would never be able to go any further than that. So they also have to practice the mundane path, but they're trying to also practice the supra-mundane path. And I think that in our practice, we're interested in both these paths, and we speak about them both. But maybe, I don't know, and I haven't kept track, but maybe we speak more about the mundane path than the supra-mundane path, because I think that actually it's more important. You know, it's actually more important for us. And so we see meditation both as a way to root out all craving and attain nirvana, but also we see it as a way of just training the mind and the heart so that we can know how to live, which seems to be, you know, more to the point for us. And of course, as I said before, Zen is a radically non-dualistic path. So in Zen, there is no mundane path and super mundane path. These are all, there's just one path. And it has, it's both absolute and relative sides. And like a jewel, you know, sometimes depending on the way the light is shining, you turn it this way sometimes, and other times it's time to turn it this way. And sometimes it's time to put out the lights altogether. So there isn't this kind of dichotomy in Zen, but in the classical Buddhism, there, it's described as a dichotomy. So that's, I just wanted to say those things as background. And this idea about the there's two Buddhas, you know, the cosmic Buddha and the more everyday Buddha is the really the subject of this first text that this is actually the second text. On page 54, under the heading of The Quest for Enlightenment, Seeking the Supreme State of Sublime Peace. Would you do me a favor and get me a glass of water? I'm having throat troubles. Thanks. So this is this Bhikkhu Bodhi quotes this because this is the Buddha telling the story of his own spiritual quest and his own awakening. And it starts in section 14. So, page 56, number 14, paragraph 14. A little more light, sure. I think there's more light, is there? Or is it all the way up? It might be all the way up. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, I guess it's all the way up. I guess that's it. Sorry. So anyway, he says that his parents didn't like it much, but he shaved off his beard and put on the robe and left home. And the first place he went is to practice with somebody named Alada Kalama. And Alada Kalama was a sage, and he learned what Alada Kalama had to teach. But then he realized, I'm just memorizing this stuff. I'm just learning it by rote, so I should have direct experience. And so Alada Kalama helps him to have direct experience, and he does have direct experience in a concentration practice known as the Base of Nothingness. And it's interesting to note that in order for him to achieve that concentration, he has to practice, develop the five powers: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And these are sort of basic lists. This is one of the lists, you know, like we did the five hindrances, this is the five powers. They're actually, the same list is repeated twice, actually, as five faculties and five powers. They're faculties when you first develop them, they're powers when you develop them more, basically. The same list, but with two different categories. And these are mentioned qualities that the Buddha thought we had to develop also. So, but it's interesting that he's going, in other words, this concentration is not sufficient. The Buddha develops these qualities, enters the concentration of nothingness, which we can imagine is a very deep concentration state. It's in the eighth, sort of in the map of the eight concentration states of ever deepening concentration. It's, I think, number five or six. So it's a very deep state of meditation. But the Buddha says, no, this isn't going to do it, because it's not yet leading to the goal. Let's see, where does it say that? Yeah, that's right, in the middle, thank you. So, he says, but it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana or nirvana, but only to rebirth in the base of nothingness. So in other words, I attain this concentration of nothingness, and what does that get me? More nothingness. I can rest in this nothingness all I want. But as soon as I get up, he doesn't say this here, but what I think what's implied here, as soon as I get up from the meditation, as soon as I stop doing this concentration, I notice that my mental stream is the same as before. Whatever it was, whatever it is that I've noticed that's keeping me clinging and grasping and in this ease is not there when I'm in the concentration of nothingness, but it is there as soon as I get up. So I haven't really disenchantment in the sense of I'm enchanted. I'm obsessed with my life. I need to be this obsessed. I'm passionate in the sense of I'm stuck, I'm hooked on my life. I need to be unhooked. It's not doing it. So he goes somewhere else. And in this place, Uddaka Ramaputta, it's interesting because Uddaka Ramaputra apparently was his father's disciple. Ramaputra, the footnote points out, means son of Rama. So Rama is now gone, and Uddaka Ramaputra has taken over for Rama, and Rama achieved this concentration called neither perception nor non-perception, which is the ultimate concentration in the eightfold division of concentration ever deeper. It's the deepest. So Rama achieved this concentration, but Uddaka Ramaputra only spoke about it. He actually hadn't realized it, but he propounded it. Well, the Buddha learned it, and the same thing was repeated. The Buddha learned it, he memorized it, then he realized, I have to experience it. He got the good instructions from Uddaka Ramaputra as to how to experience it, and he did. So Uddaka Ramaputra said, you be the teacher now, because this which my father realized, you have also realized, and I haven't. But the Buddha had the same thought. No, this doesn't lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana, but only to rebirth in the concentration of neither perception nor non-perception. So as long as I'm meditating in this concentration, I'm blissful, I'm happy, but as soon as I get up, it's the same old story. So I have to move on. So he moves on. Still in search, and I'm reading on page 58, number 17. Still in search, monks, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Uruvala near Senaganama. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms resort where I could beg, you know, and eat. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and a nearby village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. And then he, in the next passage, he then says, and this is what happened. I I achieved awakening right there. So this leaves out a lot. Somehow in this telling of the story, you know, the Buddha left out a whole lot. And the thing is that you, if you want to find the whole story, you have to, it's a little bit here, a little bit there. The Buddha never sat down and told the whole story. You know, wherever you see stories of the Buddha's life from beginning to end with all the parts included, it's because there's several epic poems in Sanskrit about it, and there have been people have, you know, cobbled together all the various parts of the Buddha's life. But it's quite interesting to think that the Buddha, when he told stories about his life, always told them for the occasion. In other words, whatever part was germane for the occasion, he told. And the rest of it didn't exist if it wasn't germane to the occasion. So in this version of the story, he goes through these two meditation regimes, and then he finds a really good spot. You know, he just thinks, I got to find a good spot to do this, and he finds the perfect spot. And he says, "Okay, this is it," and then that's it. He finds what he's looking for on his own. In the next section, a philosopher asks him. And this is another occasion. Has there never arisen in the Buddha a feeling so pleasant that it would invade his mind and remain? He would become obsessed with this pleasant feeling. He couldn't get rid of it. And has there never arisen in Master Gautama a feeling so painful that it could invade his mind and remain? So the philosopher asks him this question. And in order to answer this question, he then talks about the painful feelings that were occasioned along the way of his awakening and the pleasant feelings that were occasioned along the way of his awakening. To make a long story short, and I'll go over some of the details of this, but basically he, as you all know, did ascetic practices and some pretty severe yogic meditation practices that caused him a tremendous amount of physical and emotional pain. And he goes through all the details of this, and at the end of each paragraph he always says, but this pain didn't obsess my mind. It came, I met it, and it went. Then, later on, when he was finished with all that, he began practicing the meditation course that would lead to his awakening. And in that meditation there was a lot of pleasure and joy, because the stages of concentration have associated with them a lot of wonderful pleasures and joys. Meditation is, you know, really fun and delightful and has a zestful feeling in the body. And you ever notice how nice the world looks when your mind is very peaceful and your body's peaceful? You look around and you think, gee, look at that blade of grass. Boy, I never noticed that before. That's really something. And everything is nice, you know, when you're meditating. So he had a lot of pleasure out of his meditation. But he said, to the philosopher, but that didn't stick in my mind either. It came, I appreciated it, and it went, and something else came. But in the course of answering this question, he tells all this, so I'll just go into a little bit of it, because this is the story of the Buddha's awakening. First, in number 17 on page 60, he gives the simile. He says, these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. And they all have to do with a piece of wood, a wet, sappy piece of wood. In the first instance, it's a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in the water, you know, pretty wet, pretty sappy in the water. In the second instance, it's a wet, sappy piece of wood that's not lying in the water, so it's still wet, but probably not as wet, right, as if it was lying in the water. And in the third instance, it's a dry piece of wood in a dry place. And the problem is, can you make a fire with this piece of wood? Well, not with the first piece of wood, no way. Not with the second piece of wood either. But with the third piece of wood, which is dry, once there's a spark, fire will come. So this is his sort of preliminary statement here. You first have to prepare yourself for the spark of awakening. So, if you are a piece of, if you're a wet piece of wood, we're all kind of wet, soggy pieces of wood, you know. If we hang out in the water, if we keep going there, you know, to the water all the time, our inner dampness is going to be going on and on and on and on because we keep putting ourselves in the water. In the second instance, we realize the folly of that, so we don't put ourselves in the water anymore, and even though we're still wet and sappy, that condition will change if we stay out of the water. And in the third instance, we have an inner readiness. So, I think this has to do with our relationship to the sensual world and the world of desire and the world of grasping. It's in us. But also, we can validate it. We can make more of it. We can encourage it. If we put ourselves in that kind of environment, which is, you know, in a way, it's an environment that's not only the outside world, but also a question of our inner decision. If we go with that inner decision and we don't really resolve to change that situation, then we'll be a wet, sappy piece of wood, soaked in water, constantly getting wetter and wetter. If we take that piece of wood out of the water, which means we make a decision to change our lives and to act in accordance with that, we might still be wet and sappy for quite some time, but little by little we're bound to dry out because the sun shines from time to time. Then, when our condition is firmer and drier, so to speak, we can catch fire. So that's what, those are his opening remarks. And then he talks about his ascetic practices. I don't know if you read this, but it's pretty dramatic. He basically, there were, I think, meditations like this in ancient India, and probably still today. Meditations that have to do with like holding your breath. And he describes the kind of wind flying in and out of his ears and the pain in his head, like a person, you know, pulling a leather strap and pulling his head and squeezing his head and so on. With my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. When I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so too with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. And his body was full of strain and overwrought, and he was exhausted by the striving. But he turns to the philosopher and says, but this didn't really stay in my mind and obsess me. It just was there while I was doing the practice and then it was gone. So he practices a number of stages of these holding your breath meditations. Then he decides that he would stop eating. He would do the ascetic practice of starvation. Before this, though, let me just read you. The deities came after he did all these holding his breath meditations. The deities came around and said, looked at him. He looked pretty bad. And they said, the ascetic Gautama is dead. They looked at him and they said, he's dead. But other deities came and said, no, he's not dead. He's only dying. And other deities came and said, no, he's not dead or dying. He must be enlightened. Because this is how enlightened people look. You know, this is the gods had the idea that enlightened people did this. They kind of punished themselves and did their body. And the idea, the theory being, if you get rid of your body, then the spirit will just sort of fly forth pure. Because the body is impure and the spirit is pure. So they had this idea, but of course they were wrong. So, and the Buddha realized they were wrong because from the inside he saw he hadn't done the work he was trying to do. So he said, suppose I cut off food. But then some other deities came to him and they said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do that, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin. In other words, even if you willfully refuse food, we're still going to keep you alive. Why? Because they want him to become a Buddha so that he can help them. So it won't work for you to not take food, because we're going to feed you anyway. It's like the person who says, I don't want to eat anything else, and the doctor says, sorry, but we're sticking this intravenous tube in you, and you're going to get this stuff whether you want it or not. That's what the gods said to the Buddha. So the Buddha, this is kind of priceless, I think. The Buddha said, if I claim to be completely fasting, while these deities are infusing heavenly food into the pores of my skin that sustains me, then I would be lying. So I can't fast. So I dismissed them, saying, well, okay, never mind. You don't have to do this in my pores. I won't stop eating entirely. I'll just eat a very little. So that's how that came about. So then he took very little food, a handful of food, whatever it was. And time went by, and he got really, really skinny. And there's a lot of great pictures. Hakuin made some great pictures of the Buddha in a state of emaciation after not eating. And then he describes this. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the joined segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside, his butt, became like a camel's hoof. This whole section is full of really funny and beautiful similes and metaphor, you know, of many of them. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. You know, the little bumps on your spine. For him, it was like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that has sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. So that if I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. And if I touch my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I defecated or urinated, I fell over in my face. I fell over, like right into the... because I couldn't stand up. I was so weak. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. Now, when people saw me, some of them said, the ascetic Gautama is black, because his skin was black. His skin was ruined by his ascetic practices. Other people said, the ascetic Gautama is not black, he is brown. Other people said, the ascetic Gautama is neither black nor brown, he is golden-skinned. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. So I don't know how they saw he was golden skin. I guess these were the same ones who thought that arhats are supposed to look like broken down bums, you know, so that their body would be, I guess to them, an emaciated, horribly, you know, ruined body was good, was a good thing. You know, so maybe they saw it that way. Anyway, he kind of realized that this was as bad as it gets. All the ascetics of the past who've also done these austerities, nobody went this far. This is, or maybe they did, but no further. This is as far as anybody has gone. But, he realized, it's not working. This is not working. So he gave it up. Could there be another way? Now, you might ask, you know, why did the Buddha go through all that, including the meditations that didn't work for him. He did all these things, and all of them he said, no, this isn't it. And in a minute we're going to find out what he did see that was it. Now, there's two ways to look at that. One is, he went through all that so we don't have to do it. Another is, he went through all that so we should go through it all too. Why did the Buddha have to, in relation to the meditation practices, pretty much this sutra tells us that those very deep meditations do not take us in the direction of enlightenment, of liberation, of freedom. But maybe we should practice them anyway, because the Buddha did. And asceticism didn't take him all the way to freedom, but maybe we should practice it anyway, because the Buddha did. Or not, maybe not. Why did the Buddha have to do this? In the story of the Buddha, before he left home, is depicted as having, think about it, absolutely the perfect life. He has the perfect life. And it's described in that way, that there was no problem. He never knew a problem. He never knew anything unpleasant. He never knew anything difficult. So maybe the Buddha had to go through all these austerities so that he could realize. I mean, he saw an old person and a sick person and so on, and so he realized that there were deep human problems, and that's why he left. But in a way, you know, he didn't experience that himself, right? He experienced it in another person, and he had empathy, and that alone was enough to make him leave home. But he didn't really have this sort of searing experience on his own of the painful possibilities in human life. So maybe that's why he had to go through all this. Even though it wasn't the way to enlightenment, maybe it was sort of like the completion of his education before the real path to awakening. Well, so the good news is that since probably nobody here has a perfect life, and since probably everybody here has had some suffering, maybe those are our austerities. Maybe we don't have to go to these lengths. Maybe this is exactly the lengths to which the Buddha went. Maybe is exactly the extent to which his life was perfect. So then we do have to practice austerities, but we probably don't have to like make a special effort to practice austerity. All we have to do is keep living, you know, and then austerities will come our way. You know, I used to always, to colleagues of mine who complained about me that I was too easygoing and I didn't, you know, beat up students and I didn't yell at them and put pressure on them, I said, I don't have to do that. They're all alive, you know, and there'll be plenty of things that they'll have to suffer over. Why would I want to make them get more suffering? You know, they'll have their suffering. It'll happen. And it always does, you know. So we also practice austerities, but not in quite this way. But, you know, the other thing about it is that I have friends who are monastics who... there's a tradition in Theravada monasticism of practicing austerities. Not exactly like this, but of practicing austerities. And sometimes the monastics... maybe I shouldn't use the word, but more or less they compete with one another, you know, in their ascetic practices. And the thing about it is that they seem to enjoy it. That there is a certain kind of enjoyment, actually, in ascetic practices. This is a hidden factor here. I mean, you don't get that in this text, but I just happen to know from my friends and my own minor efforts in ascetic practice that there's something actually quite energizing about it and wonderful about it, so that there may be more to this than just, you know, hit yourself over the head because it's good for you to feel the pain, but there may actually be a sense in which doing something rigorous and difficult and giving up something, you know, may give strength and even a kind of happiness that we're not thinking about. So I just throw that out there just in case anybody wants to give up chocolate or something for a month or a week or tonight, maybe just tonight. Yeah, so now we come to now we come to the path that the Buddha discovers that is the one that's really going to work, the method that's really going to work. And wouldn't you know, it just was something that came into his mind at that particular moment. Did you ever have this happen to you? Like, this happened to me today. I had a problem. I didn't even realize it was a problem. And all of a sudden, yeah, that's what to do. Yeah, so it sometimes happens like that. And that's what happened to him. He said, oh, yeah, here's what to do. He remembered all of a sudden, he had this flash, this memory flash of being a little boy. And his father was he was accompanying his father at some ceremony or other. And he was sitting under an apple tree. And he was just sitting there. It was nice and peaceful. And he just sort of spontaneously started following his breath, as any little boy will do, of course. And and then he, in a very easygoing, gentle way, entered into a state of pleasant and happy concentration. And he remembered that all of a sudden, here these many years later. And he said, that's the thing. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit down somewhere just like I did when I was a boy, and I'm going to meditate in just that way. Very childish, spontaneous, easygoing meditation, which more or less is Zazen. That's what Zazen is. The idea is that Zazen is an imitation of this meditation of the Buddhas, exactly, of the Buddha. So then he realized, well, but, you know, I'm so skinny, I better eat something. So there's a long story that is not told here. This kind of tells you Bhikkhu Bodhi's tastes, you know, that he didn't include this story, which is one of my favorite stories, and I won't go into it now because to really tell it takes a long time. But basically, somebody brought him food, is what it comes down to. And he ate and went into those meditation states. And now the jhanic states, the meditation states, are described. And I'll read you that part because it's interesting. As a bunch of meditators here, you'd be interested in this. It's number 35. With the subsisting of thought, 34. Now when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, the first concentration state, which is accompanied by thought and examination. So in this state of meditation, there's still thinking, and there's even still the kind of thinking where you can examine something. But there's also rapture, which I think means physical ease, and happiness, which I think means ease of mind, born of seclusion, born of meditation. But, he says to the philosopher, this pleasant feeling didn't overcome me or capture my mind. With the subsiding of thought and examination, so now thought and examination fall away, and he enters into the second jhanic state, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, which means that the mind and the body are unified and there's not the thoughts are not coming that take the mind away from the body. So that the consciousness and the body are in one place. In other words, the body is the only thinking going on. And ordinary thought and examination fall away, and there's still rapture and happiness. So the difference between the first and the second is jhana is the thought not appearing. And then the rapture fades away. The rapture of the body fades away. And instead of the rapture in the body, there's an equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending mind. Now I experience happiness with the body, which I think means a more refined state, which is not exciting or enticing, but more equanimity, more settled. And that's the third jhana. So in the third jhana, in other words, the rapture falls away and the feeling of the jhana is more equanimous or more settled. That's the third jhana. With the abandoning, in the third jhana, it says, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily, but such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, so there's a pleasant feeling in the third jhana, more settled, but still a pleasant feeling. Now in the fourth jhana, there's the abandonment of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, I entered and dwelled in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity, by such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not, but such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain, he's telling the philosopher. So this is a progression from, because there's always some danger of getting caught, right, where the happiness and the rapture is too noticeable. And one notices that as a problem. And in other descriptions of the jhanas, what happens is you enter the jhana, and at first it's very pleasant and wonderful, and then as you're in the jhana for a while, you realize, oh, there's something here to be refined, because this is a little bit, there's something here that I could get stuck on, get caught on, and that's unpleasant. There's a hook, you know, in this state. There's a little bit of a hook. It's a little addictive. And I feel that. Now I'm feeling that. So I want to refine further. And you're refining always in the direction of more settledness, more peacefulness, and less something there to be, make a fuss over. Does that make sense? So basically, the four jhanas are a progression. In the beginning, there's still some thought and discursive mind. But then there's unification of mind and then a progression toward more and more settledness and more equanimity. Now, when my mind was settled to that extent, I directed it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, three births, four births, and so on and so on and so on, 100,000 births, many eons, and so on and so on. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, etc., etc. So he sees with his this mind, which is so settled and so concentrated, he sees his own personal destiny over large spans of time. He understands his own, where he's come from and where he's going. He sees his own life. Here it's described as many, many lifetimes, but even if you didn't see it that way, you would see it as seeing your place in the cosmic order and understanding why you're born in this life as the person you are. It's not a problem, you know, it's not an issue, it's exactly as it should be. Given this whole expanse of time and space, you must be what you are here and now. And it's absolutely clear. You understand it. So that's kind of a wonderful thing to feel. You can imagine how the Buddha felt, oh, you know, really good about that. Then the next thing is seeing his own place in the cosmos. He then directed his mind to the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, meaning everybody else, not just him, but everybody, the entire. So now he understands the world and all that's in it, and how it's just exactly right as it should be, and how the arising of this world in this moment couldn't be other than it is, given the whole thing that he has seen with his own eyes. So, It's. I mean, I can really appreciate, you know, they're using all these words and this very specific imagery of seeing past lives. But I think to take it literally would be to do it a disservice. But just imagine the feeling of the absolute and total rightness of your own life and of the whole world. You know, it has to be this way. Everything that's ever happened has been exactly choreographed for this moment to be as it is. And to feel that, and to feel completely rooted in that moment, in the world, knowing your place in the world, and knowing the scope of the whole world. This is a beautiful insight that the Buddha had, and a beautiful feeling that he had on enlightenment night. And then, when my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints, the kleshas, the defilements, as we said earlier, the root of it. At their root, I saw, and I let go. I directly knew as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is. These are the taints. This is the origin of the taints. This is the cessation of the taints. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints, of the suffering, in other words. And when I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of existence, and from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I directly knew, birth is destroyed, the spiritual life has been lived, what has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and the true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute, but such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. And this story is told several times in the Pali Canon, always with little variations here and there. But that's the gist of it. There's the all the stories, there are some stories that leave out a lot, but all the stories that include always include these elements, the meditation practices that are deep but not going in the right direction, the austerities, the practice of the jhanas. In some versions, the Buddha attains awakening from the second jhana. He goes through four jhanas, and then comes back to the second jhana. So it differs, and you can't get too. And you know, the difference between the jhanas is, in my opinion, not as hard and fast as it's the text would make it out to be. And also remember that you can enter and leave a jhana in an instant. So it's not like you're going to be in a jhanic state. I'm in the first jhana for half an hour, and then I'm in the second jhana for half an hour, and then like that, you know, it may be some oscillation. So anyway, one text does say that the second jhana is the one that led him to, first of all, recognition of all of his own lives, all the lives of all of us, and then final release, letting go, and final peace. So, I won't go any further tonight, and I think next time I'll talk about the chain of causation. Let's take just a few minutes. Anything to bring up about this before we have a discussion? Yeah.
I just have a question. When I read that, I want to know what the difference is between the four jhanas and the eight trance states. It seems like there's overlap there.
You mean the eight?